This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Liz Ahl's new collection of poetry, Beating the Bounds, is a proclamation that says, I live here now. Here, in this case, is New Hampshire, specifically Holderness. In poems that feature town moderators, transfer stations, and the perambulation of town boundaries, Ahl explores what it means for her to have finally set down roots in this place. I spoke with Ahl in her office at Plymouth State, where she teaches poetry. Liz, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
So this is a book that kind of comes full circle for NHPR in a way, because as you write here, it was inspired by a story done by Brady Carlson, who used to host All Things Considered, about this strange New Hampshire law that requires perambulation. Tell us a little bit about that.
It is current New Hampshire statute that every 7 years forever, that's a quote, every 7 years forever, the borders of the towns should be walked by the selectmen or their appointed representatives to you know, just reestablish, recertify the town boundaries. And this is actually a custom from centuries ago in England. It was a parish custom. And while we don't really need to do that anymore to establish the boundaries, I know that some people do still enjoy perambulating the towns. And yeah, when I heard that story, I was working on a second draft of this book, which was previously under a different title, and hearing the story and learning about beating the bounds or perambulation helped me figure out the last stretch of the book. So I'm really grateful to New Hampshire Public Radio for that story. This book used to have a different title, you know, and when I wrote that title poem, it helped me finish the book.
What themes or metaphors did you see buried in this law, or in the ideas behind the law, that sort of tied things up for you?
In the book, I am writing a lot about finding myself in middle life as someone who was a Navy brat, whose dad was also a Navy brat. I'm not from any place special. I wonder if I'm from here now. I don't have my two generations buried here, so I know I can't be from here yet, but I've lived here since 2001. It's by far the longest I've ever lived anywhere in my life. I don't have another home place. So I was writing about the ways in which we establish and articulate home. You know, how do I, is this it for me? Like, do I live here now? It seems like such a ridiculous question. Of course I live here now, but I guess really the question behind that question was, am I gonna die here? Is this it? As someone who moved every 2 or 3 years growing up, have I stopped? And part of the writing for me was a struggle that I didn't realize was gonna be a struggle. About 7 years into living here, I had a real writer's block problem because, and I hadn't had the opportunity to realize that part of my whole posture and perspective as a writer was the posture and perspective of someone who was going to leave, who knew she was going to leave. And so I got to be new. I got to perceive a place as an outsider. That was always a very comfortable position for me. And now I find myself in the new and sometimes uncomfortable position of negotiating my insider-ishness. I test out in some of these poems the pronoun we, as if I am a part of the us of New Hampshire, which feels so weird to me, but and sort of presumptuous. And yet I'm as from here as I'm from anywhere. So the idea of figuring out where home is by kind of testing your own sort of borders and boundaries, what's my here, what's my there, and how do I sort of establish and reestablish that? And I loved that it says in the statute, every 7 years, forever, as this kind of work that you're never finished doing. The boundaries will never settle. If you let them go, you know, someone will build a house right on the line and, you know, then who gets the taxes, or someone will encroach on your land, or you'll forget if you don't do it every 7 years, sort of where one thing ends and the other begins. And I just, as I was working on a lot of these poems, I found those metaphors and just the idea of that ritualistic regular assessment of the borderlands just super rich.
As you wrote about home, was there one poem in here that you felt really nailed it, nailed that theme?
Oh gosh. Certainly the birdhouses poem about the difficulty of being housed. It's a poem in which I contemplate all of my failed attempts at putting up a birdhouse and actually having a bird move into it, and thought about my own transience and refusals in some way of home.
I love that poem. Can you read that for us?
Oh, sure, sure. Let me find that. Birdhouses. I've never been able to persuade a bird to live in one, though my persuasion's on the lukewarm side. I just make birdhouses available, nailed to a tree, say, or propped at the top of a post. Even if I knew how to push, I don't like to. Fixer-upper flying squirrels transported chewed tufts of pink insulation into one I'd been given as a gift, mounted even on a good green metal pole. Another proved excellent shelter for bees. Who knows how many packed into that humming tenement? Of course, I'm sure I also snubbed or ignored or just wasn't able to see perfectly fine houses set in my path as I flitted the first half of my life from coast to coast, pausing even in the flyover states for rest and sustenance. I, too, have been difficult to house. I, too, have been suspicious of what was offered in exchange for staying put. Walls and a floor, a door that locked on rooms filled with heavy things, with family. The closest I've come to housing birds is the flycatcher nest pasted beneath the eaves of the small shed I had vaguely planned to be a writing getaway. Just above the door, to a lot of extra space they don't really need, the prolific little squatters, even with all those babies, all those poems I never wrote there.
So you found your birdhouse, metaphorically speaking.
Yes,
New Hampshire.
Yes, yes.
So, I mean, how has New Hampshire changed the way you write? Has it changed the way you write? You seem to use it as your subject matter in this book and possibly in other places, I'm not sure. How has it changed you?
So I think it would be different if I'd moved to Manchester. Right. So it's not New Hampshire as a state, but certainly rural northern New Hampshire. And rural is important to me. I've not lived in such a rural place before. I'm interested to know how much of it is New Hampshire and how much of it is having lived here for such a long stretch of years. I think if I'd landed anywhere for a stretch of years this long, I would have had to come face to face with this notion that I spent so much of my life writing as an outsider and as someone who was going to be moving on. And so now that I stopped moving on, that changed my relationship to the place I was in. But I do love the oldness of New Hampshire. I mean, I think coming here, you're extra aware of this idea of staying put. When I first lived here, I lived in Bridgewater, which has one of the sort of oldest or most continuous Old Home Day celebrations in the state. And my neighbors said I should go up to Old Home Day. And so I drove up Bridgewater Hill in my Corolla with my Nebraska plates. I moved here from Nebraska, and they had a tradition, a 100-year-old tradition of the beanhole beans, and you'd stand in line and have your beans and your bread and your pickles. I don't know why those three things, but I thought that was fascinating. And that the people who were cooking the beans were the descendants of the people who cooked the beans. And that inside the town house were photographs on the wall of past Old Home Days from like the early 20th century. And then they were going to take this year's town picture. So it's 2001. They're getting everyone together. And I stand back. I go to stand by my car because I'm not from here. I shouldn't be in the picture. And my neighbors who invited me said, no, you get in. Everyone gets to be in the picture. You live here now. And so I just remember standing there for that picture, acutely aware of all of the pictures inside. And I suddenly felt this sense of history and connectedness to it, that I don't think I'd felt that before. And then, of course, there are things like town meeting and the transfer station and sort of the live free or die spirit that I think are touched on in some of these poems. So it's New Hampshire, but it's particularly rural New Hampshire. And I think because of its age, because of its oldness, its sense of American history and personal family history, the generations at Old Home Day really made an impression on me.
Speaking of transfer station, could I get you to read the poem Transfer Station?
I'd be happy to. I just need to find it here on page 43. Transfer Station. There is a place for everything. Divided neatly, all the bins are labeled, one for anything you'd think of, and a man to ask when you're not sure. If it can tear, is what the dump attendant says about what paper is allowed. He'll also clarify that dump is not what we should call this place, from which all leavings are removed to distant dumpish parts unnamed and scarcely known. It's all transferred, all swept away, except, of course, for items left in the single wide identified as the swap shop. We're Yankees, still beholden to the old proverbs and promises to use it up, to wear it out, to make it do or do without. So here we leave what can't be trash, the artifacts for which no bins exist. Old corporate coffee mugs, cassette tapes, china, blenders, books, and plastic corded telephones, small furniture and Scrabble boards, red-eyed alarm clocks, pots, and pans. And from these shelves and tables, take for free whatever things we want to bring to useful life again. Our waffle iron, hand mixer, the extra wine glasses, the pot we plant with flowers every year, all came from here. I don't recall what all we've left behind in trade. I guess this is a transfer, too, from someone else's life to this way station at the edge of town, and then, at last, to us, to ours, this pot I fill with snapdragons, this glass from which I drink my wine.
So while I was reading this book, I read that poem aloud to my girlfriend because I liked it so much. And she said, she is not a poet, by the way. She likes to read, but she doesn't write. And she says, I like it because I know what it's about. And I think that's a problem that a lot of poetry has now, is that it's in some ways written for other poets, but yours is not. So I don't know if you take her comment as a compliment, but do you?
I absolutely take it as a compliment. I think that, you know, of course, the curse of the accessibility, right? Oh, your work is so accessible. I love nothing more than giving a reading at a town library and being approached at the end by someone who says something like, I don't really like poetry, but that was all right. I was surprised at how endurable that was. So I do think this is a poem, this is a book in which I am speaking to the community. I think I'm aware, as I was putting this book together, that I wanted to say something not just about my home, my new home, my neighborhood, my neighbors, my surroundings, but kind of to them as well. And so it's part of trying out that pronoun we too. But I think also I would say to folks who get frustrated by maybe less narrative poetry, more sort of experimental feeling poetry, that I think poetry invites us to sometimes make a different kind of sense of something that's not necessarily about telling a story, but about sort of having an emotion. Or so I do I do write pretty clear, narrative, accessible poems myself. And I feel like I've gotten good feedback for that. But I also like to champion some of the more avant-garde, if you will, stuff. Because I just don't want readers to pressure themselves like they have to understand it all at once. Like, what is understanding anyway? You know, and if you read a poem one time and you don't sort of get it right away, you know, it's short, read it again. You know, it's not a test. You don't have to get it all at once. You don't have to get it. You know, flip to the next one. Life is short. There's a lot of poetry.
You quote Robert Frost in this book a couple of times. Is he an influence of yours?
I'm influenced by the idea of Robert Frost. Like, Robert Frost, where is Robert Frost from, right? Robert Frost is from,
depends on what state you're from.
Right. Well, and he's originally from San Francisco. So I'm interested in the idea of Frost becoming a New Englander, if such a thing is possible. I'm interested in the uses of Frost, how emblematic he is. And I don't imagine myself emblematic. I'm interested in him as a transplant, and him as Frost as a writer who, you know, in his own way wrote his vision of New England, which I guess I am doing as well. And I do appreciate, though, I will say, I think one way that Frost influenced me as a writer when I look at these poems now is he has a darkness to him. A lot of these poems are about mortality. And I think that I had a great graduate seminar in school in which we looked at Frost, and the only Frost I'd ever looked at was in, you know, grade school, and it was, you know, it was the poem you had to memorize, right? What, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. And you had this, you were given this idea of Frost that it turned out was not really true, and that the actual Frost, you know, who my expert professor knew a lot more about and was so much more interesting and problematic and dark. And so there is a darkness in these poems that I do think may come in part from a similar place that Frost's darkness came from.
Tell us about your origins as a poet. Did you know from a very early age that you wanted to write poetry?
I knew from a very early age, sort of embarrassing, but not embarrassing enough that I won't say it, that I enjoyed when adults were pleased with things that I did. And one thing that I did was I wrote things, and I got lots of praise for that. And I do think I wrote things because I loved to read things. I could spend a weekend just getting lost in, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia or Harriet the Spy, all those great Ellen Raskin books like the Westing Game. I do think that I felt amazed at how words on a page could transport me. How crazy is that? And I do know that some of my early efforts were to see if I could do that, sort of for myself, I guess. I also liked writing because it was something I could do by myself. I didn't have to share it with anybody. I didn't have to talk to anybody about it. And that changed. To me now, writing is incredibly social. But early on, I liked spending time by myself, and I craved the approval of adults, and writing got me both of those things. And then I had lots of opportunities, very lucky opportunities with, you know, after school programs and summer programs where I got to sort of take myself seriously as a writer. And so I had really good teachers. I liked to read. It's not a particularly dramatic story. But it's mine.
You teach now. You're teaching at Plymouth State. What advice do you give your students?
Read. Read more. Keep reading. I'm a firm believer that we need to be reading more, much more than we're writing. I'm not inclined, as my teacher was, to encourage students to send their work out into the world too soon. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be the arbiter of what's too soon. Students can obviously do whatever they want, but it's enough to just, you know, work on it honestly and devotedly. It's okay to just work on it for a while. I think there's a, you've probably noticed too, there's definitely a culture of the prodigy around writing in the last two decades or so. A lot of prizes that are called younger or emerging.
New Yorker does their 40 under 40. And
There's a poets and writers feature on debut poets every year. And one of the pieces of information they include is everyone's age, which I think is really revealing. And for me, I've published a bunch of chapbooks, but this is my first full length collection. And I am closer to 50 than to 40. So, you know, it took a while. I want my students, most of my students don't aspire necessarily specifically to quote unquote be poets, whatever that means. The train of thought just left the station without me.
Well, you were talking a little bit about not only what it means to be a poet, but you are not like your professor in that you don't force people to submit. It's just when it's ready, it's more important to keep working at it, is what I think you were saying.
Yes, absolutely. And to practice at drafting and revising in ways that are sort of surprising and, I don't know, I want to say natural. That's a loaded word. I think we when we first learn about revision, we learn about this sort of linear, idealized process in which you compose a draft. You then compose a second draft, which is, of course, better than the first draft, which we know right away, you and I know, is a big fat lie. Sometimes it's better. Sometimes it's worse.
Sometimes you take all the heart out of it.
Right. And then other times, what you thought was the heart of it was not actually the heart of it at all. And so there's no sort of six steps to a successful draft that I can give that will work in every situation. And so you have to, as a writer, you have to develop an endurance and a patience. And then somehow you have to learn to know, I don't know if I've learned this fully yet, the difference between a draft that you need to just abandon and a draft that you just need to work harder on. I don't think I've mastered that yet.
That is comforting for me to hear. As someone who has been told by professors, this story, in my view, cannot be fixed. I remember that line specifically from a professor. This story, in my view, cannot be fixed. And I always want to go back and fix that story. and then publish it somewhere and send them a hard copy of the journal and be like, what do you think about this?
You're reminding me of another thing I say to my students, in addition to read, 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 is whatever pronouncements I make as if they are messianic law, be skeptical of them. Because whatever rule I throw down, already someone is out there breaking it in interesting ways. And I'm not here to be a gatekeeper. I'm not here to enforce rules. I am here to share with you what I understand about the conventions of this genre, help you figure out which ones you're interested in and which ones you're not interested in, and helping you just be as honest with yourself as you can about that. For example, show, don't tell. Okay. Sometimes you have to tell, though. Right? It's not that you never tell. And it's not just an easy rule, right? It's not, description is not always necessarily superior to narration. Sometimes you need narration. Stuff like that. Like, I mean, it would be great. It would be so great if it were all a set of rules that if you just did these 17 things every time, success would follow. Have you ever read On Writing by Stephen King?
Oh, twice.
I used to use that in creative writing, and we'd get to this moment where you realize, you know, where he's, you know, hauled out his typewriter and put it on top of the washing machine in the back of his trailer after working his second of three jobs that day. And he's just hiding out in the laundry room on zero sleep. And he's showing up that day and doing his pages. And, you know, we come to the Stephen King story about how to, you know, be a writer, waiting for him to reveal the secret formula. And we get to that point in creative writing when we discuss that text, and we're confronted with the fact that there is no secret. There's no magical formulation. Stephen King showed up every day when he was exhausted, when he wasn't, when he felt like it, when he didn't, and he cranked out the pages and he threw away that first draft of Carrie. And so he's, in that sense, he's not even special, right? I mean, of course, Stephen King is special, but we could choose to show up like that every day, you know? So now it's on us, right? Now we have the secret information that we need. And who among us is going to choose to show up every day like that? And then it's sort of depressing and exciting all at once for my students and I. Like, we could do it. Ugh, could we? Could we do that? Would we do that? With no guarantee that it's going to end like Stephen King's story ends. And some of us do. Some of us do. I don't show up every day. I show up like every other day.
Well, Liz, we're glad you showed up enough days to produce this book. It's wonderful. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, NHPR, for helping me to finish this book. Thank you so much.
That's Liz Ahl. She is the author of the new collection of poetry, Beating the Bounds, published by Hobblebush. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Liz's bookshelf at our website, nhpr.org. We are always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you. Tell us about the book that you couldn't put down. The best way to do that is by email. Send it to books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at @NHPRBookshelf. And be sure to catch our upcoming live recording of the Bookshelf from NHPR on Wednesday, April 25th at the Toadstool Bookshop in Peterborough. I'll be sitting down with author Elizabeth Marshall Thomas to talk about her latest book, The Hidden Life of Life. The event is free, but space is limited, so we've got tickets for you to pick up for free at nhpr.org/events. This is the Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.